I first learned about Jay's work as an overexcited undergraduate at the University of Waterloo. I remember having learned about how neurons work and having what I thought was a genius idea that I excitedly brought to my undergraduate thesis advisor. And I said to him, what if you could write a little computer program that would simulate what a neuron is doing, hook them all together, maybe you could understand how the mind works. And he gave me a sort of flat, sarcastic look and wrote down a little reference, and I went to the library where I encountered this book, which blew me away as it has blown many people in our profession away. And a couple of years later, when I was looking for a graduate school to attend, I was very fortunate that Jay happened to also be looking for a student that year and was willing to take me on. And I guess I've never really looked back. However, of the people that you're going to hear from today, I'm actually the only direct collaborator with Jay. And the reason is that the ideas that are contained in this book and that themes that have run through Jay's research for the 25 years since they were published have really become the themes of cognitive science in many ways. Even if you are not prone to adopt the PDP modeling formalism that has shaped a lot of Jay's work, it's certainly clear that the idea that representations are graded, that processes and representations are widely distributed and interactive, are tenets that many of us sort of take for granted more or less today in a way that they didn't before these books were published. And so the other speakers in today's series are scientists who are doing outstanding work that sort of reflects those themes from Jay's work, even though they haven't directly collaborated with them. So after I've spoken, we're gonna hear from Nicholas Kriegskort, who has really done some pioneering work looking at the distributed nature of neural representations in the brain using multivariate pattern analysis. Bruce Hayes, who is a linguist whose work has really elucidated the sort of underlyingly graded nature of sublexical representations in language comprehension. And Mike Spivey, whose work very elegantly illustrates the ways in which language comprehension and perceptual processes interact. And these are all themes that sort of directly or indirectly resonate with a lot of the work that Jay has contributed to the field over the years. But I get to go first. And I am someone who is committed to the modeling framework as a particularly useful set of tools for thinking about not only cognitively how our minds work, but also how the underlying neuroanatomy of the brain might give rise to these cognitive constructs. And what I'd like to do in my talk today is to convince you that these models are extremely useful not only as cognitive models, but also as sort of tools for understanding the functional neuroanatomy of the brain. And I'm going to do that with reference to this very simple feed-forward backprop network that Jay spoke about in his talk yesterday that Rummelhart introduced to the field. And I want to share with you some of the insights about the neuroanatomy of the cortical semantic network that I feel I've gleaned by thinking about how this model works. So just as a brief reminder, or in case you happen to miss Jay's talk yesterday, the idea behind this model is to understand how it is that we encode and retrieve information about everyday common objects like pine trees, roses, robins, canaries, and daisies. The model has two input layers with localist representations of the individual items that you might know about, and localist representations of what we call context. These are sort of contextual constraints that tell you what kind of information is relevant to me right now. What kind of information do I want to retrieve? So here we've got ISA, which is sort of I care about names, is, can, and has contexts. The layers on the left project forward to layers on the right so that when inputs are activated, activation cascades sort of feeds forward to the attribute units over here, which locally encode the different properties that I happen to know about. And if the weights are configured in just the right way, the network should be able to activate all and only the attribute units that sort of are true of this object given this context. So Initially, of course, we initialize the model with small random weights, and it produces a sort of undifferentiated mush across these units. But the idea is that you can compare the undifferentiated mush to the true answers to the question, the canary can grow and fly and sing, and use the discrepancy between these to make small adjustments to the weights throughout the network, so that after iterating this with many different sort of items, contexts, and answers, the network can discover for itself a set of weights that allow it to correctly complete all of the item, context, query inputs. Now, there's three interesting aspects of this model that I want to highlight for you to make my first point. The first, which Rummelhart noted and Jay noted in his talk yesterday, is just that the model is capable of learning interesting semantic or conceptual similarity relationships amongst the items in its environment. Okay? So although there's no overlap in the input across these items, activation of a given unit produces a pattern of activity here, and if you just look at the similarity structure of those patterns once the model has learned, you can recover similarity structure that more or less corresponds to the corpus of propositions that the model was trained on. So the pine and the rose, pine and the oak are represented as quite similar, somewhat similar to the rose and daisy, and the plants overall are more similar to one another than they are to the animals. And as Rummelhart pointed out, that similarity structure can provide the basis for knowledge generalization and induction, which is a key point of having a semantic memory. The second interesting property is that the model can figure out for itself which properties in the environment are important for organizing its internal representations of different concepts. I'm going to make this point with reference to a sort of abstract simulation here. This is a model with the exact same architecture. There are 16 items in the environment and four contexts. And we construct training patterns for this little demonstration in the following way. There are parts, movements, textures, and labels. And every item has two parts, two movements, two textures, and two labels. And each of these attributes occurs across four items in the training corpus, four and only four. However, the properties are organized in a particular way. Half of them are what I'm going to call coherent properties. What that means is that items that happen to share one of these red properties also happen to share three other of these red properties. So for the red things I've highlighted here, if you share one of these parts, you also know that these four items share movement, texture, and labels. Okay? So those four attributes consistently are observed together in the environment. Whereas the other properties highlighted in green here co-vary independently of one another. So the four items that happen to share this part, this guy, this guy, this guy, and this guy, otherwise don't really have anything in common in either the green or the red properties. Okay? So given this structure, it makes sense to organize your internal representations by the red properties, because if you know one of the red properties, you can make inferences about the other ones, whereas the same is not true of the green properties. And if we train this model and look at the representations that arise in the first hidden layer that I've labeled shared object representation here, this is what we see. Very early in learning, there's little organization, but very quickly the model learns to basically form little clusters that correspond to groupings of items that share the coherent properties, even though those items differ on all of the incoherent properties. And that early arising organization persists all the way through until the model has mastered the corpus. So even at the end, everything spreads out a bit, but the predominating organizing factor is whether they share the coherent properties. And because this is true in the way that the model learns, it ends up also learning to activate the coherent properties much earlier in learning and much more strongly when training has finished. And the reason is simply that when I represent items 1 to 4 here as similar to one another, and then I learn about one of their coherent properties, that learning tends to generalize to the other items in the cluster. So those four items all sort of support learning of the properties they share, which happen to be the coherent ones. Okay? So this is a simple mechanism for understanding how coherent covariation in the environment can lead us to view some properties as being more important for organizing concepts than others. And as a cognitive model, this was a sort of important insight for understanding a variety of phenomena in conceptual development. Now, The third point that I want to make is that these abilities really depend on the particular neural architecture of this simple model. So I'm going to illustrate this property by showing you what happens if we change the architecture of the simple feedforward model in what is really a very reasonable way. So I'm going to replace these two hidden layers with the following architecture. Let's imagine that instead the network was set up so that there were separate pathways for mapping from input to the part attributes, or the movement attributes, or the texture attributes, or the labels. I actually believe that this corresponds to theories that some people who study semantic cognition have about the architecture of the brain. But if you divide things up this way and train the same model on the same abstract patterns that I just showed you, this is what you see when it's learning to activate the coherent and incoherent patterns. There's no sort of preference for separating out the coherent information from the incoherent information. And this is because this kind of a model has no basis for finding the underlying structure. The reason is very simple. When you split the pathways up, if I learn that item one or item two has a certain set of parts, the weights that I'm changing in learning that item to part association are completely non-overlapping with the weights that change when I learn the item to movement association, or the item to texture, or the item to labels. There's no physical point in the network that's even capable of detecting the fact that things that share coherent parts also share coherent movements, textures, and labels. The regularities are divided across these different property types. In contrast, in this kind of an architecture, whenever I learn that item one has a certain set of parts, I need to make changes to all of these blue weights, which in common are processing all of the items and all of the contexts. And so any change I make to accommodate this new piece of information needs to also work for the other items and contexts that I know about. And as a consequence, I'm capable of sort of detecting the higher order structure that really organizes the domain. So if you take this very simple feedforward model, you know, seriously, with respect to neuroanatomy, it offers the following hypothesis, that in the cortical semantic network, there ought to be a place that contributes to the processing of all kinds of concepts and all kinds of contexts so that you can be sensitive to the higher order covariation that's important for organizing the concepts. And I'm not actually going to show you this data, but I will just note that, you know, in the 10 years or so that have elapsed since we did these kinds of simulations, there's now accumulated a very broad amount of evidence, indeed in cognitive neuroscience, that the anterior temporal lobes of the brain constitute just such a cross-domain and cross-modality semantic hub. There's evidence from a progressive degenerative syndrome called semantic dementia that produces a global semantic impairment from focal degeneration of the anterior temporal lobes. And there's new evidence coming out of Manchester now using RTMS to show very similar effects in healthy people. And there's accumulating evidence in fMRI, PET, intra and extracranial EEG for a sort of anterior temporal lobe cross-modal and cross-domain convergence zone. And I would suggest that all of that evidence is quite interesting, but the insights provided to the model allow us to understand why it should be the case that the brain is organized that way. Now, I've rushed through this work because it is relatively well known now, and I wanted to suggest to you that, you know, this is not the sole insight about the functional organization of the cortex that one can get from this very simple model. There's another aspect of the model's behavior that I haven't commented on that I can illustrate to you very briefly. Supposing I teach you that this object has an omentum inside, and I ask you which of these two objects also has an omentum inside. Most people will agree that it's the robin, because these two things are phylogenetically similar. But if I change the question and tell you that this thing eats omentum, and I now ask you which of these two things eats omentum, I think most of you are likely to suggest it's probably the polar bear, because you know that the robin and the penguin occupy very different habitats and can't possibly have access to the same sources of food. So the point is that the way that we inductively generalize some new blank property depends not only on the similarity between the sample item and the choice items, but also on the nature of the relationship between the blank item and the property here. We need to have a way of understanding how it is that that sort of relational information constrains the inductive inferences that we're prone to make. And the Rummelhart network provides a very simple solution to this question in its representation of these sort of contextual constraints. Here at this second layer of representation here, The model needs to take the context-independent representations it's learned and combine those with inputs about the particular situation and context that it's in order to do two things. First, it needs to shunt the activation toward the subset of attributes that are relevant to the context. And secondly, it can reorganize the similarity structure down here at the base representation in ways that suit the current context. I'll just show you this very briefly. Here's a multidimensional scaling of the context-independent representations, trees, flowers, birds, and fish up here. And here are scalings of the next level of representation in two different contexts, the same 16 items here. In the can context, the model has learned that, you know, all the trees and flowers can do is grow. That's the same thing. So I may as well represent these distinct items as all similar to one another because they can all do the same thing. Whereas in the is context, which asks the model to report perceptual surface properties, the trees and flowers are quite different from one another, and so they get represented as quite different from one another. With the consequence that when the model is taught new information in these different relational contexts, it shows different patterns of inductive projection. And in the last couple of minutes here, what I want to suggest to you is that this also offers a hypothesis about neuroanatomy. Specifically, that there ought to be somewhere in the cortical semantic network that is representing your current task goals or task constraints, what I need to do with this concept right now, and that interacts with the content-bearing semantic networks in ways that allow you to get out the right information for the task. Now, of course, there is a huge literature suggesting that lateral aspects of the prefrontal cortex are intimately involved in semantic retrieval, perhaps of this kind. I know Tony Wagner, Sharon Thompson-Schill, and others have suggested these kinds of ideas. This is a review slide from Jordan Grafman's lab. And we've also known in neuropsychology for many years that damage to left frontoparietal circuits can produce global and domain-general semantic impairments. Beth Jeffries and Matt Lamb and Ralph has done a lot of elegant work recently characterizing the nature of these impairments, and they've coined the term semantic aphasia to refer to these kinds of patients. So what I've been doing lately in my lab, largely with Stephen Verheyen from the University of Leuven in Belgium, is trying to understand whether this simple feedforward neural network model can help us to understand the similarities and differences between two different forms of semantic impairment, those that arise in temporal lobe pathology and those that arise from frontal pathology. So I'm just going to show you a little bit of the work that we've been doing in that vein. We've been using a model very similar to the Rummel-Hart model. The only difference is that we've introduced an additional layer of hidden representation here, so that rather than directly influencing the context-sensitive representations here, the model needs to learn distributed representations of the different contexts and use those then to combine with the item representation. And so the key idea here is that the item representation corresponds to what the anterior temporal lobe is doing. And the context representation corresponds to what the frontoparietal networks are doing, representing the current task and using those to influence how activation flows through the semantic network. And what we can do with this model is look to see how it behaves in model analogs of simple neuropsychological tasks when we introduce noise either to the either to the item representation or the context representation as simple analogs of neuropathology. So I want to draw your attention to two very robust effects in the study of semantic dementia. The first is the notion that more specific concepts are more vulnerable to impairment. We can see this very nicely in a simple category verification task. Participants see a word like kingfisher, followed by a picture which can either be a kingfisher or another bird, and they just have to say yes, no, does the picture match the word? And what we manipulate is the level of specificity of the name. So kingfisher is very specific, bird is a somewhat more general name, and animal is a still more general name. So in the model, if we noise up the item representation and just look at the activation corresponding to the names animal, bird, and kingfisher, what we see is this precipitous decline of activation on the more specific label. a somewhat less precipitous decline on the basic level and a much gentler decline on the more general information. So you get this profound effect of the specificity of the concept, which we also observe in patients who have temporal lobe pathology. So this is D prime on this kind of task discriminating targets from distractors for general labels, basic labels, and specific labels. And in particular, you observe this nice flip-flop where basic level concepts are better in the healthy group and worse in the dementia cases, just like in the model. But if we damage the context layer in this model, what you see is certainly precipitous decline, but with no real overall specificity effect. All levels decline at the same rate when you damage the context representation, which is just what we see in a cohort of these semantic aphasics. These are 10 semantic aphasics, mild, moderate, and severe. They get very bad at the task, but with no preference for the more general information. Let's see here. I'm going to speed up because I believe I'm eating up my time very rapidly. I'll just briefly mention there's a similar effect in frequency effects for naming. We always see robust effects in semantic dementia. You see little effect in semantic aphasia. The same effects fall out of the model when you damage the context versus the representation. And I'm going to make one other very brief point, which is that although these examples highlight differences between the patient groups, sometimes the patients look remarkably similar in both the model and the task. So this is a seven alternative force choice word picture matching task varying the semantic proximity of the distractors. In this case, we see very big effects of proximity in both the SD and the SA cases in the model simulations and in the patient data. And I'm just going to skip ahead here in the interest of time. All of this is by way of saying that there's an interesting question in neuropsychology. Why do the semantic aphasia patients sometimes look like the semantic dementia patients and sometimes not? This very simple feedforward model captures these effects relatively easily. The answer to this question is something I don't know yet, but that is actually the point. The great thing about these models is that they distill the sort of essence of these hypotheses about how neural processes work in a simple form that allows the theorist to interrogate the model to work out why these effects ought to be happening. And that, in turn, provides a great source of hypotheses about why these patterns of behavior are observed in patients who have the brain damage. So I just want to briefly thank Matt Lambin-Ralph, Elizabeth Jeffries, and Stephen Verhaen, who contributed to this work. But I particularly want to thank Jay, not only for his career contributions, which have benefited all of us, but on behalf of all of Jay's students and mentees, thanks from the bottom of my heart. Not only is Jay a great scientist, but he's a tireless advocate for his students. It's not everybody who would put pictures of their student collaborators on the actual data slides when he gives his talk, but Jay has always been a real source of inspiration and support for those of us who have taken on this challenging profession. So thank you, Jay, and thank you for your attention. So we have a little bit of time while Nico is getting set up here, if there are any questions about that work. Yes.
Or whether or not you should distribute the representations of the items and the context.
Yes.
Is it possible to sort of evolve the architecture of the network such that these connections, whether to distribute or whether not to distribute, is done automatically?
Yes. So it's interesting. One of the reasons, another reason I like these models is that they do give you a formalism that allows you to understand how experience-based weight change interacts with sort of innate constraint. In this case, the innate constraint is the way the model architecture is set up in the first place, not only the patterns of connectivity, but the activation functions and the learning rule and so on and so forth. So in that simple little example, the idea would be if, you know, your genes set up the network in this way that there are separate pathways, you wouldn't be able to learn the stuff that you need to learn. And as a consequence, I think that gives us some insight, you know, why should it be that the way our brains ended up constructing themselves is in such a way that there are pathways that seem to process all kinds of information for all kinds of objects. It's because that's what allows us to get at the deep structure of concepts that we need to promote inductive generalization the way that we need to do.